Welcome to a Trouble and Strife podcast. In this podcast, I talk to Joan Scanlon and Debbie Cameron, editors of the new Trouble and Strife Reader, a collection of articles from Trouble and Strife's 20-year history. We are also joined occasionally by a very enthusiastic border collie.
So, Debbie, tell me a bit about how you got involved in Trouble and Strife.
Well, I read Trouble and Strife from the beginning. It started coming out in 1983, and by 1984, I was actually contributing to it, though I didn't have anything to do at that time with producing it. And I continued to contribute over a long period of time. I just wrote articles quite regularly. And in the end, the collective took the hint and invited me to join, which I did in the early 90s. So I was a member of the editorial collective for the second half of its 20-year existence.
And what was the context in which Trouble and Strife entered your life? What were you doing at the time when you started reading it?
I suppose at that time, in 1983, I'd just got my first academic job. After I'd been spending my time as a university student. And I think it was a very good magazine for people like me to read because it was intellectual, but it was also political. It wasn't like a scholarly journal, like the sort of thing you'd read actually for your academic work. But it did have sort of in-depth analysis. So it was different from, I mean, I also read many other feminist magazines that were around at the time, and most notably, of course, Spare Rib, which was probably Britain's best known and most read feminist magazine. It was a monthly. It had a kind of news agenda and, you know, a very wide circulation within the women's movement. Trouble and Strife was a bit different because it was trying to be more in depth. It wasn't trying to speak to, you know, everyone that might call themselves a feminist. It was trying to represent a particular current of feminism, which was radical rather than liberal or socialist, and also materialist. It had a particular connection to a certain kind of feminism represented by its French sister publication, Nouvelle Question Féministe.
And Joan, how about you? Were you already involved in feminism when you started reading it, or had you come to it in some other way?
I got involved with feminism around the same time as the first publication of Trouble and Strife in the early 1980s. And at the time, I wasn't involved in the publication of it. Like Debbie, I joined the collective in the second decade of its publication. At that point, I was working at London Contemporary Dance School, and we used the space that I then worked in for Paste Up and for the illustration of the magazine. And in fact, the illustrations were one of the things that I think made the magazine so appealing and so readable right from the beginning. It's certainly one of the things I found most compelling about it, the wit, the humour, the visual appeal of the magazine. It broke up the kind of theoretical and discursive aspects of the magazine with a lot of humour and visual interest. And it certainly widened my knowledge and understanding of a range of issues that were then currently the subject of debate in the culture at large and amongst feminists. We've tried to reflect in the reader that particular strength of the magazine, which was the way in which it covered the controversies that took place during the 80s and 90s without trying to resolve them. The question of motherhood and childcare, for example, that is covered very early on in the magazine, is left quite unresolved, but it gives readers of different kinds points of access to that debate.
Do you remember the first article you read that kind of got your interest? Was there something in particular?
Absolutely, absolutely. The first issue of the magazine, Steve Jackson's piece about psychoanalysis, The Desire for Freud, and Kath Jackson's cartoons, both remain absolutely lucidly in my mind. It was becoming fashionable amongst academic feminists at that time, psychoanalysis. And Stevie Jackson's piece was the most lucid and brilliant demystifying critique of Freud and psychoanalysis. And that, for me, is one of the strongest aspects of Trouble and Strife, which was the way it tackled academic theory and fashion and made it possible for readers not just to have a gut feeling that this wasn't relevant or helpful to feminism, but to have a kind of strong handle on and to be able to articulate the reasons why some of these trends were anti-feminist.
Yeah, I had a similar experience. I mean, one early article in Trouble and Strife was somebody, analysing the Greenham Common peace protest, which was very prominent at the time, and kind of articulating a feeling that I'd always had, that it really wasn't in tune with my kind of feminism. You know, Trouble and Strife often represented a point of view which people didn't associate with orthodox feminism. You know, there was this idea of, you know, if you were a feminist, you'd believe this, this and this. You'd be in favour of Greenham Common. You would think it was great or whatever. If you had your doubts about it, you know, that sort of spoke to you not being what was publicly considered to be a feminist at the time. And TNS often articulated this alternative point of view that was feminist, but wasn't in tune with what people thought feminist orthodoxy was. So this article was saying, well, actually, you know, the Greenham Common protest is based very much on an idea of women as, you know, naturally more peaceful and more nurturing, quite different from men, not capable of violence, this sort of thing that I was very uneasy with, and that piece gave me a, you know, spoke to me and in a certain sense for me, and I found Trouble and Strife often did that.
Well, Trouble and Strife billed itself as a radical feminist magazine. Were you a radical feminist when you started reading it? What was your route to radical feminism?
Yes, I suppose I was, really. I mean, I can't remember a time when I wasn't some sort of feminist, even though in the beginning I didn't have a feminist political vocabulary to describe it. I think I was aware from a very early age that we lived in a world that was very unfair to women. You know, that was really part of the air I breathed right from childhood, you know, my family, at my school, which was a girls' grammar school, and in the first workplaces that I had jobs in, it was just taken for granted that women were inferior to men, they were less intelligent, what they did and thought mattered less. There was overt institutionalised discrimination, which until I was 18 wasn't even tackled in the law, let alone the culture of the north of England where I lived. And when I had my first job, it was my mother had died when I was 18, and I'd been forced really to step into her shoes, taking care of the household and my younger siblings. And I discovered that the world of being, you know, doing domestic labour and having a low paid job was really, really awful. And I remember going to the library in my lunch hour and reading sort of the feminist books that they had there, classics of the time like Psychoanalysis and Feminism and Sexual Politics and The Dialectic of Sex, and thinking, well, actually, you know, what relevance has this got to me? So it wasn't until I did finally go to university that I started to encounter other people who called themselves feminists, who engaged in consciousness raising, you know, talking about politics, beginning with your own experience. And I suppose it was at that point that I encountered the notion of radical feminism as something a bit different from what I'd been reading in the library. And one of the things that happened during my time as a university student was the Yorkshire Ripper case, a man who went around murdering women, many of whom were prostitutes, in the northeast of England where I was studying. And because of the tape that was sent to the police, they believed that he was from the area where I was living. But the things I heard men saying about this and the way that women felt about it really did make me more sympathetic to what I was encountering as radical feminism, which had a very strong concern with things like male violence against women, you know, which had not featured in the sorts of books that I initially read. And I myself had been more concerned with things like, why did women earn so little? Why did they have to do all the housework? But this really focused my attention on other issues that I think at the time were sort of central radical feminist issues. So by the time I came to read Trouble and Strife, I did define myself as a radical feminist, meaning somebody who wasn't going to beat about the bush about the fact that the basic conflict and the basic exploitation was between men and women. It wasn't about the class struggle, it wasn't about people having sort of retrograde attitudes or whatever. There was an actual conflict of interest, and there were things going on that were really quite extreme and had to be tackled in a radical way.
And how about you, Joan? Were you a radical feminist when you first started reading Trouble and Strife?
On the cusp of. I'd just become involved with a training centre that was in Cambridge, involved with providing training and education for opportunities for women who were either from the Asian community or from the working class community in Cambridge who were not associated with the university in any way. But I had come by that at that stage from a completely liberal arts kind of literature background, and what radicalised me was the extraordinary hostility of the liberal establishment to autonomous women's organising. I kind of moved into the support of the Women's Centre and the training and education programme, partly because at that stage I was interested in meeting other lesbians, and it was shockingly unpolitically motivated on my part, but it politicised me, and it set the work of the autonomous women's movement into such marked contrast with what was going on with liberal feminist projects within the university, that it compelled me into radical feminism with a vengeance. And like Debbie, my experience of being at university in the north of England, and in particular the Ripper case, certainly brought the foreground of the issue of violence against women in ways that certainly I welcomed the kind of analysis that radical feminism brought.
How is it distinguished, say, from liberal feminism?
What I think radical feminism has distinctly in opposition to liberal feminism is an analysis of structural power relations in society. Liberal feminism focuses much more on individual rights and choice and equal opportunities and so on. Insofar as it assumes there's a level playing ground, that if you assume that things are equal and that we're talking merely about discrimination or about individual attitudes, then you're never fundamentally going to change the things that cause inequality in the first place. And I think that one of the things I feel very strongly now and didn't realise before I became a radical feminist is that liberalism is in many ways a greater enemy to feminism and to any radical political project than even the right wing, insofar as you don't have a clear enemy with a clear opposition. You have an enemy that appropriates and dilutes and sometimes just kind of completely reappropriates the actual very things you've set up as kind of radical projects in the first place.
What changes have you seen in feminism since Trouble and Strife began, and why is it that you're bringing out the reader now?
Well, in some ways, I think feminism has been much more mainstreamed, if you like, but that has made it in more liberal in the way that Jones just talked about. So, you know, feminism itself is often referred to, and some tenets of it, you know, women's equality, is in a certain way common sense now, which really wasn't the case in 1983, and certainly not in 1973, or the end of the 70s when people first started talking about having a radical feminist magazine. So in some ways that's good. Feminism isn't itself an eccentricity, but it has become very watered down in the way that it's talked about, and also, of course, it's become much less of a mass political movement. You don't get the same, you know, you could get women on the streets protesting during the Yorkshire Ripper era. You could get sort of massive campaigns for something like to outlaw rape in marriage. And now I think, I mean, I'm a university teacher. I work a lot with young women, women aged from 18 to 21, and they don't see feminism necessarily as something that's very relevant to them anymore. They tell me that their mothers were feminists. And their mothers are, of course, very much the same age as I am. Some of them are probably younger. So one of the reasons for doing the reader is to give people who are interested in feminism, perhaps who weren't around in the period that the reader covers, the 80s and the 90s, because they are too young, a better historical sense of what was actually going on. Because when I ask my students what they think feminism is, they tend to mention either the very, very theoretical stuff that they come across in the academy. So a feminist is somebody like, you know, Judith Butler, who's a philosopher and who's talking in a very complicated way about, you know, gender being an illusion and all the rest of that. Or they think it's some woman who's, you know, broken through the glass ceiling to become the chief executive officer of a company in the city or something. It's the kind of having it all woman because you're worth it kind of stuff. And neither of those speaks to my own sense of what feminism historically was within living memory. So one of the things that I hope the reader will accomplish is give people who are interested in that some sense of what actually was going on in at least one kind of British feminism at a certain time. Now, if they can relate to the sorts of things that are being said, and I think that then the stuff in the reader doesn't just have historical significance. We've chosen deliberately to reprint things we think are of lasting value and lasting and, well, current topicality. So we've got pieces on things like religious fundamentalism. The piece we've reprinted was written in the wake of the Rushdie affair, well before 9/11 and the so-called war on terror that has pushed us to the top of the agenda now. But a lot of what it has to say is still very relevant. So I do hope that a new generation of readers will discover radical feminism as something relevant to them. But even if they don't, at least it's a historical record that doesn't kind of distort in the way I think the media have distorted the understanding of feminism's recent history for many of the young women that I teach.
And do you have the same sense, Joan, that things have, the history has become distorted? What would you like to bring to a new set of readers?
I agree with Debbie that the history has been unrepresented. I mean, the history of radical feminism is not part of the history. I'm slightly more optimistic about young women in that I very recently just went to see a play about the hijab by a young 21-year-old Asian woman, which was brilliant and articulating very much the same arguments as we were articulating in Trouble and Strife 20 years ago. And I think that one of the things that characterised Trouble and Strife was even though our circulation was never very big, when women actually found it, even those who didn't identify necessarily as feminists at first, they found it informative, illuminating, completely compelling, and often very much chimed with their understanding of the issues that we were writing about there. And I hope that the reader will have some of the same function, because if you look at, for example, the young women who are attending the Reclaim the Night marches every year now, which is growing in number, and the perception that many of our illustrators have, who have contributed to the reader, that there is also a generation of women who are now hungry for this kind of material. I do hope that the publication of the reader and the launch of the website will actually generate new debate from this perspective.
Thank you for listening to this Trouble and Strife podcast. Please join us at troubleandstrife.org as we continue to upload back issues and generate new content.